Victor had spent many years of hard work at Stelwit in the 1980s. He began wondering about the validity of his achievement, and emotionally destitute he voiced a prayer, "Dear God and dear Brotherhoods, if you exist, please let me know if this community is for real. Please let me know if I'm just wasting my time here, if I've risked my family and everything else for nothing. Please let me know if Richard Canninger has been telling the truth and if I should stay." Victor went to sleep and the next morning awoke to a telephone call. The voice on the other end said, "Hello, I'm calling in reference to your request for more information. I'm calling to answer your questions about Richard Canninger and the validity of your presence in Stell. Perhaps we can arrange a meeting." A date was set, and a few days later a large Mercedes pulled up in front of Victor's house. An elderly Chinese man and a young man of perhaps 15 stepped out. To Victor's surprise, it was the young man, Jim, who did the talking while the Chinese waited in the car. The young man said it was his first assignment from the Brotherhoods and he was sent to provide Victor with crucial information. Jim confirmed that Richard Canninger had indeed been contacted by the Brotherhoods as a young man. But later they came to the conclusion that he would misuse the information, and they assigned various keepers who tried to limit the damage Richard might cause. Despite Richard's fabrications, Jim said that Stell had gained positive attention of the Brotherhoods and had the potential to develop in the planned direction. Jim encouraged Victor to stay in the community and help provide leadership at a critical juncture. Because of this visit and information, Victor decided to stay in Stell. In the middle of the 1990s, Victor began to question the experience with Jim, and with the help of internet he succeeded to trace Jim's phone number. When Victor phoned Jim, he was surprised that he had been able to find him, but he confirmed the information he had provided some years earlier. Later, when Victor tried to search the internet again using Jim's name, all information had been deleted. With the help of Walter Cox, I tried to contact Victor by email to confirm the story. Unfortunately, I received no answer, and I have come to understand that Victor is rather reticent regarding this experience. In spite of his sharp criticism of Richard Canninger as a manipulative con man, Walter Cox has a positive view of the philosophy he presented and still regards Stell as a nice place and charming community. In a letter to me January 20, 2008, he summed up his opinion, "My own experiences have convinced me that I do have mentors on the other side, who are watching out for me. Victor's experiences are also loosely corroborative, and I do see evidence of a concerted effort on the of some organization to influence the course of human history. Nowhere, however, does the evidence rise to the level of clear substantiation of the Brotherhood's existence, so my belief remains just that, a belief." When comparing Richard Canninger's Lemurian philosophy with the esoteric tradition, Blavatsky, Bailey, Lawrence, it becomes obvious that Canninger made a personal mixture of diverse sources. Although there is high idealism and basic psychological soundness in much of his teaching that is in line with esotericism, he also used dubious and contradictory sources. In a letter from Heather Norris December 13, 1985, three of Canninger's sources are given: The Morning of the Magicians by Louis Pauls and Jacques Bourdieu, The Spear of Destiny by Trevor Ravenscroft, Hitler, The Occult Messiah by Gerald Sister. These works must be regarded as not very reliable, popular occult books. This becomes very obvious in Richard Canninger's contradictory statements on Theosophy and Alice Bailey. In The Ultimate Frontier, p. 68, 1982 ed., Theosophy and Rosicrucianism are mentioned as preparatory schools, but in the audio series Stell Forum, No. 7, 1981, Canninger he states, "Madame Blavatsky had been contacted by two Shambler who happened to be visiting London at the time and invited her to come to Tibet. They gave her a whole bunch of false history. They were essentially totally in control hypnotically of Blavatsky. Some of the concepts of Blavatsky has to do with Aryan supremacy, Aryan blood being supreme over other. Alice Bailey's control, a telepathic hypnotist who called himself Jewel Puel, was a Tibetan Shambhalist with the same connections as the two men who seduced M. Blavatsky, co-founder of the Theosophical Society, into being their psychic mouthpiece against Western civilization. Their call to lose one's will in order to experience closeness to God is a ruse to bring mankind under their control. This is a total misconception of theosophy and the teachings of Alice Bailey that Kenninger picked up from The Morning of the Magicians and incorporated later in his own philosophy. Was Richard Kenninger and Stella an experiment in esoteric intervention, using the terminology of Jacques Vallée? An experiment that was aborted because of Kenninger's character flaws. In some respects, the experiences of Richard Kenninger resembles those of Helena Blavatsky and Alice Bailey, who were contacted at an early age and given an assignment to be implemented later in life. If true, the basic question remains: who gave the assignment? Esoteric Archives. As librarian and archivist, one of my favorite movie series is The Librarian, starring Noah Wyle as the librarian Flynn Carson. After a very special interview and scrutiny, he is hired by the Metropolitan Public Library. To his great surprise, he is taken to a very old and secret section of the library, housing not just rare manuscripts but artifacts like the Ark of the Covenant and Excalibur. His first mission is to bring back the Spear of Destiny, which has been stolen from the library. The story is a charming combination of Indiana Jones type adventure and mystical romance. What I find even more fascinating is that the basic theme in the series is literally taken from the esoteric tradition and adapted to popular culture. Secret Esoteric Archives and Libraries is often mentioned in the classic works of Helena Blavatsky, Henry Alcott, Charles Leadbeater and Alice Bailey. It is stated that the Adepts, the Planetary Guardians, have created large archives where the real history of mankind is preserved. An idea that has my deepest sympathy is on this cosmic Alcatraz. Cultural barbarians has throughout history destroyed manuscripts and libraries. The Islamic religious extremists in IS is the latest example. Earlier in history, Christians were no better. Whether a few archives for the unexplained will be spared from this destiny, only time will tell. During my many years of study of the classics in esotericism, I have especially noted references to secret libraries and archives. I wish to share some of these references, which may be of interest to academic scholars as well as that band of cultural and intellectual heretics who are fascinated by or possibly connected to the Higher Intelligence Agency. Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. In her introduction to The Secret Doctrine, Helena Blavatsky has several pages discussing the esoteric archives. The secret doctrine was the universally diffused religion of the ancient and prehistoric world. Proofs of its diffusion, authentic records of its history, a complete chain of documents, showing its character and presence in every land, together with the teaching of all its great adepts, exist to this day in the secret crypts of libraries belonging to the occult fraternity. P. 34, along the ridge of Alton, Toga, whose soil no European foot has ever trodden so far, there exists a certain hamlet, lost in a deep gorge. It is a small cluster of houses, a hamlet rather than a monastery, with a poor-looking temple in it, with one old lama, a hermit, living nearby to watch it. Pilgrims say that the subterranean galleries and halls under it contain a collection of books, the number of which, according to the accounts given, is too large to find room even in the British Museum. P. 24, in Henry Steele Alcott's Old Diary Leaves, second series, is presented an intriguing experience of a visit to a secret place of the Adepts. In connection with this visit, Alcott comments on the hidden archives, all the buried ancient libraries, and those vast hoards of treasure which must be kept hidden until its calm requires its restoration to human use, are, she said, protected from discovery by the profane, by illusory pictures of solid rocks, unbroken solid ground, a yawning chasm, or some such obstacle, which turns aside the feet of the wrong men, but which mire dissolves away when the predestined finder comes to the spot in the fullness of time. P. 45. A Theosophical Study of Great Interest is The Astral Plane, 1895, by Charles Leadbeater. This, in my view, is the most comprehensive and detailed taxonomy of non-human entities and phenomena from the multiverse perspective of the esoteric tradition. In his introduction, C. Jinnah Rajadaza mentions that this was also the opinion of one of the adepts who consequently wanted a copy of the manuscript for the Museum of Records of the Great White Brotherhood. The astral plane was regarded as a landmark in the intellectual history of humanity. This museum contains a careful selection of various objects of historical importance to the masters and their pupils in connection with their higher studies, and it is especially a record of the progress of humanity in various fields of activity. It contains, for instance, globes modeled to show the configuration of the Earth at various epochs of time. It contains various old texts relating to extinct and present religions, and other material useful for an understanding of the work of the life wave on this globe, our Earth. In several of the volumes by Alice Bailey, amanuensis for the Tibetan, there are references to the archives of the adepts. The Tibetan often mention checking information found in the archive. I but present the facts as I know them from my access to records more ancient than any known to man. Esoteric Psychology, Volume 1, p. 394. There is an interesting and ancient proclamation found in the archives of the adepts. A treatise on white magic, p. 616. If you were a disciple who had access to the archives wherein instructions for disciples are contained, you would be confronted by six large sheets of some unknown metal. These look as if made of silver and are in reality composed of that metal which is the allotrope of silver and which is therefore to silver what the diamond is to carbon. Upon the sheets are words, symbols, and symbolic forms. Discipleship in the New Age. Volume 2, p. 249. Finally, a reference from the outstanding and erudite Swedish esotericist Henry T. Lawrence. With his usual Blavatskyan temperament, he discussed the secrecy of the adepts and their work. The condition of culture is universal brotherhood, and it is obvious that we have a long way to go before we are there. Civilization with technology is quite compatible with barbarism, which fact the 20th century clarified to everyone having a wee bit of judgment. Knowing that fanaticism systematically eradicates everything it does not approve of, the planetary hierarchy has since 50,000 years been collecting the essential things from the history of mankind in its inaccessible museum. There the symbolic writings of the knowledge orders are preserved as well. That museum can be visited only by causal selves who have acquired objective causal consciousness. Good provisions have been made so that no barbarians will have any opportunity to destroy it, as they did with the Alexandrian Library. Archives for the Unexplained, AFU, is today the custodian of very large collections of books and magazines on paranormal phenomena as well as esoterica. We are not very secret, of course, as our collections are open to anyone, whether academic scholar, skeptic or journalist. Perhaps in the distant future we could become a branch of the Real Esoteric Archive. In that case I will in my next incarnation make an application for employment as librarian. I guess Flynn Carson wouldn't mind a colleague in his tough and exciting work around the world. I love his comment in The Curse of the Judas Chalice, when confronted with a group of brutal thugs, "I warn you, I am a librarian." Paul Foster Case and the Esoteric Tradition. Recently one of my blog readers, a former member of Builders of the Aedetum, BOTA, recommended an interesting biography of the founder Paul Foster Case, 1884-1954. Builders of the Aedetum is a modern mystery school in the Western esoteric tradition, the teaching based on the symbolism of the Holy Kabbalah and the Sacred Tarot. The biography, Paul Foster Case. His life and works is written by Dr. Paul A. Clark, founder of the Fraternity of the Hidden Light. What especially interested me was the information that Paul Foster Case was a friend of Alice Bailey and also claimed having physically met and been instructed by one of the elder brothers or adepts referred to as the Master, R. Rakhochzi or the Count de Saint Germain. An excellent, scholarly biography of this fascinating and intriguing adept is The Comte de Saint Germain, Last Scion of the House of Rakhochzi by British author Jean Overton Fuller. It has the advantage of being written from both a mainstream historical perspective and ending with a chapter on the theosophical or esoteric view of the master. R.G. Novotan Fuller is also the author of Blavatsky and Her Teachers, an investigative biography. When builders of the Adytum and esoteric orders with similar origin and teachings refer to the Western mystery tradition, the curriculum is usually a mixture of Hermeticism, Kabbalah, Tarot symbolism and alchemy combined with ritual initiation ceremonies and ceremonial magic. Many of these orders trace their historical roots and connection to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, founded in London 1887. From this origin, many offshoot societies and orders developed, including several of the modern neo-pagan groups and Wicca covens. I made a rather extensive study of the Western mystery tradition in the late 1970s. Reading included classics like Ritual Magic in England by Francis X. King and Sword of Wisdom, MacGregor Mathers and The Golden Dawn by Ethel Colquhoun, but also books by Gareth Knight and W. E. Butler. My favorite in this tradition became Leon Fortune, author of many books on the Western mystery tradition and founder of the Fraternity of the Inner Light, later renamed Society of the Inner Light. I corresponded with several members belonging to this tradition and was once, without my wish, even elected Swedish representative of the Fellowship of Isis, headquartered in Ireland. After some years in the rather sterile and ascetic milieu of the Anthroposophical Society, Diversitynatan Theosophin, Franz Hartmann, I found this form of pagan nature mysticism refreshing and wrote an article with the title Pan Lever, Renaissance for Naturmystikin, Pan is Alive, the Renaissance of Nature Mysticism. During this period I also made a short sojourn in the theosophically oriented liberal Catholic Church. Although I was fascinated by ceremonial magic and understood the modus operandi, especially after reading The Science of the Sacraments by Charles Leadbeater, I eventually realized that the Western mystery tradition as presented by these societies and orders were not my cup of tea. I looked for a more academic and intellectual approach to the esoteric tradition and finally discovered the writings of the scholarly and erudite Swedish esotericist Henry T. Lorenzi, a disciple of the adept H. Galerian, head of the branch or department of the Planetary Guardians organization especially concerned with the development of science and with a special interest in the psychical research groups around the world. I assume this would today also include the UFO movement. Early in life, Paul Foster Case developed a profound interest in the history or playing cards, which eventually led him to a study of the tarot cards and their symbolism. But he also, as very young, had several mystical experiences that can be described as expansions of consciousness. He also began to hear an inner voice. Being well aware of modern psychological theories and psychopathology, he believed the voice to be a manifestation of his subconscious mind. But the voice was sometimes very specific. For instance, when searching for information in a library, the voice told Paul, "If you will reach for the third book from the left on the top shelf, and turn to page, you will find the reference you're looking for." Paul Foster Case's spiritual studies and quest led him in 1918 to contact with a representative of the Thoth, Hermes Lodge in Chicago, an American successor organization of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, where he was initiated in 1920. Open criticism of some aspects of the teachings resulted in his expulsion from the order, and in 1923 Paul founded the School of Ancient Wisdom, later Builders of the Adytum, B.O.T.A. Knowledge and inspiration to found his new school came in a rather unexpected manner to Paul. In the summer of 1921 the phone rang at his apartment. A man at the other end stated briefly, "I presume you recognize my voice." To his astonishment, Paul realized it was the voice he had heard in his head for many years. The man suggests a meeting at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Nervous and unsure of the outcome of this adventure, Paul enters the hotel and is met by an olive-complexioned and dark-haired man of slight build and neatly trimmed beard. He introduces himself as the Count de Saint-Germain. Paul is reassured that "I am a man, just as you and the adept are. Explain his reason for the rendezvous." If he accepts the proposition of a period of training and instruction, Paul will be able to restate the ancient wisdom in terms of modern psychology and a training system, eliminating some of the outworn old elements that has dogged the current presentations in the Western mystery schools. Paul accepted this dharma, which resulted in many meetings with R. Paul later, in rather familiar terms, referred to his adept friend R. as the boss. This reminds me of Theosophist Henry Steele Alcott, who had met several adepts personally and often called them the boys. Accomplished esotericists and bibliophiles will probably notice that the physical description of R corresponds to the presentation given in Initiation, Human and Solar by Alice Bailey. He is rather a small, spare man, with pointed black beard and smooth black hair. P. 58 Cloth bound dead, R. was obviously very candid regarding the choice of Paul for the intended project, that while he was not particularly impressed by Paul's personality, he was absolutely the best they, that is the masters, could find for the job they had in mind. They had to work with what they had at hand. This is an interesting comment explaining why disciples with their personality faults and idiosyncrasies seem so inadequate for a chosen project. It also takes away the glamour that disciples should be regarded as infallible teachers of esotericism because of their contacts with the planetary guardians. Listen to what K.H. had to say about Blavatsky: but, imperfect as may be our visible agent, and often most unsatisfactory and imperfect she is, yet she is the best aviable at present, and her phenomena have for about half a century astounded and baffled some of the cleverest minds of the age. The Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett, Letter 2, pp. 9, 10. As is often the case with esoteric teachers, Paul Foster Case received his share of unfounded rumors and criticism from conceited and self-righteous moralists. Dr. Paul A. Clark relates a very human episode during a crisis period in Paul's life when he was alone at a hotel room in Reno, very sick and no money left. The week before, he had become acquainted with a card shark at a gambling establishment and a woman who proved to be a prostitute. This couple found him unconscious at his hotel room, called a doctor and paid all expenses. They nursed him back to life, until he started to recover and could continue his journey to California. Later Paul used to tell his classes, "Don't forget to send love and gratitude to a prostitute and a very dishonest card dealer, who had so much love in their hearts, that they went to a man they did not know at all. They spent their own money to feed him. Please remember this when you start evaluating what is and is not highly evolved. It can be misleading." Paul Foster Case devoted his whole life teaching esoteric philosophy and directing builders of the Adytum. But he was also ordained a priest in the liberal Catholic Church and a Freemason affiliated with lodges in New York and Los Angeles. His method of presenting the esoteric tradition with the help of the Tarot and Kabbalah is one of many paths, leading to the same goal. Personally, I find the use of too much old symbolism, like Kabbalah, frustrating, and adhere to the views on this issue by Henry T. Lawrence as more in line with present-day scientific thinking. Interested students are referred to the chapter Symbols in Knowledge of Life 3. This is not to belittle the teachings and effort of Paul Foster Case, who, according to my understanding, was a genuine disciple of the planetary guardians and exponent of the esoteric tradition. Where have all the lodges gone? The title alludes to the old folk song by Pete Seeger, "Where have all the flowers gone?" I came to think of this famous song when studying the history of the Swedish Theosophical Society, EDIA. In 1925 there were 44 local lodges in cities all over Sweden, even in, at that time, rather small towns like Boden, Eslöv, Kungsbacka, Säffle, Arjivla. Theosophy can almost be regarded as a form of people's movement in 1920s Sweden, with a deep cultural impact. These and other interesting data on the Theosophical Society in Sweden I have found in an unpublished manuscript, Fichter Samuel Eder Theosophisk Tidskrift 1890-1968, Facts Gathered from Theosophical Magazine 1890-1968. This is an impressive documentation amassed and typewritten by Mr. Garance Odirkvist, board member and archivist for the Swedish Theosophical Society, EDIA. Garance Odirkvist. Garan Soderqvist's documentation would be excellent and important data for any academic scholar writing a doctoral thesis on theosophy in Sweden. As I have mentioned several times in this blog, I find the lack of scholarly research on this subject quite remarkable, especially since academic interest in what is named Western esotericism has experienced a renaissance during the last decades. A few academic essays have been written at Swedish universities, but no in-depth research resulting in a doctoral thesis. Today, the Swedish Theosophical Society have only two lodges and six local representatives, according to the society homepage. The decline in lodges and membership is often debated among active theosophists. The decline started after the crisis when Jiddu Krishnamurti in 1929 renounced his role as world teacher and rejected theosophy as a valid world view. Instead, he started promoting a form of confusing Advaita mysticism which is still published in many theosophical journals. Sweden is no exception, and the result is an unhappy mixture of esotericism and mysticism which can hardly appeal to the intellectual student. This could be one of the reasons for the decline in membership and lodges. I commented on this problem in the mailing list Theos Talk in 2013. In my view, one of the great riddles of the theosophical movement is how so many theosophists can still promote the teachings of Krishnamurti. I can well understand the frustration of Geoffrey Hodgson when confronted with the peculiar form of Advaita mysticism of J.K. An intellectual quicksand that gets you nowhere and with no relation to esoteric science. Blavatsky, with her forthright manner and volcanic temperament, would probably have given J.K. a harsh reprimand if they had lived during the same age. And Lawrence, with his Blavatskyan temperament, is very critical and clear in his analysis of J.K. Unfortunately, this essay is only in Swedish. Finding books by Krishnamurti in theosophical bookshops is like finding books promoting atheism in a Catholic bookshop, while the nice and naive manager of the shop doesn't understand the difference between the two radically different worldviews. A sad state of affairs. Various esoteric sources are quite clear in their assessment of Krishnamurti. Here a few quotes. Krishnamurti's Advaitism, which is not to be confounded with the recognized form of that noble philosophy, will, I fear, lead his followers nowhere except perhaps to hypocrisy and self-delusion. Cyril Scott, The Initiate in the Dark Cycle, 1992 ed. 139. Krishnamurti is a warning example of the risks involved in the forced cultivation of latent qualities. His later production indicates that he lapsed to the stage of the mystic, and from there to life, blind factitiousness, rather reminiscent of Zen Buddhism, according to which one experiences true reality by emptying one's consciousness of all its content acquired throughout one's incarnations. In that procedure, one is supposed to attain to nirvana or annihilation. Is there any crazy idea that people will not swallow? Henry T. Lawrence, Knowledge of Life 3, 6.10. According to Alice Bailey, the Krishnamurti episode was an experiment that backfired. Alice Bailey, Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, 1980 ed. 171. Lawrence is of the opinion that Charles Leadbeater and Annie Besant overestimated Krishnamurti's capacity and forced him to an intellectual and spiritual overtraining. Theosophy as a movement could still continue to have a progressive cultural impact if theosophists abandon the mysticism of Krishnamurti and continue promoting the esoteric tradition as a science, as exact as any academic discipline. They must also be more open to and understand the continuity of the tradition in the writings of Alice Bailey and Henry T. Lawrence. If not, the Theosophical Society will in the future only be of interest to scholars of history of religion and academic esotericism. The great cultural influence of theosophy in Sweden will hopefully be recognized, studied and documented by academic scholars in the near future. Theosophy has influenced royalty, artists, writers, scientists, politicians, philosophers and intellectuals during an important and revolutionary phase in Swedish history. One small of this impact I have documented in my book Gudarna Återvandrar, UFO or den esoteriska tradition, Return of the Gods, UFOs and the esoteric tradition. The Swedish UFO movement was actually founded by active members of the Theosophical Society, EDIA. From a global perspective, there is still much research to be done in this direction. The Henry T. Lawrence Esoteric Legacy. The last decades has seen a remarkable renaissance for the scholarly interest in the esoteric tradition. What in academia has been named Western esotericism can now be studied at universities in Paris, Sorbonne, Amsterdam and Exeter.